When you golf in Missouri, the courses are so close, you'll spend more time on the fairway than the freeway. Reserve a tee time at the Regal Osage National, designed by the king himself, Arnold Palmer. Take a cart ride on the wild side in the breathtaking surrounds of Payne's Valley, designed by Tiger Woods. And after the back nine, there's still world-class dining and distilleries, shops and spas, museums and more. Find your new golf MO in Missouri. Start planning your golf getaway at visitmo.com.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to five pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.
Welcome in to a very special Thursday edition of Friends from Work, a podcast about all things in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. And it's hosted by me, Kyle Sconewill, and my longtime friend, Robbie Earle. Robbie and I have hinted at on social media at the FFW podcast. We've hinted that we've wanted to get into doing a few more interviews on this podcast, like the one we did with Matthew Berry last year. And if you missed that interview, be sure to go check out that episode. That was really fun. But earlier this week, we had the very special chance to speak to Abraham Reisman. He recently published a biography on Stan Lee, and we thought you guys might like it. The book is called True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, and it's full of fascinating insight into the man who became the face of Marvel Comics. We had a stinking blast talking with Abraham, and we think you guys will really enjoy hearing what he had to say. That said, we jumped into the deep end like pretty quickly, so we wanted to be sure you guys had some context before you hit play. As many of you know, Stan Lee is credited with the creation of many of Marvel's most famous comics and characters, including, among others, the Fantastic Four, the Incredible Hulk, Thor, Doctor Strange, Iron Man, the X-Men, and of course, Spider-Man. But as Abraham explains, the unique manner in which these comics were created has given rise to some debate over exactly how much credit, if any, should go to Stan Lee and how much should go to artists like Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, who designed and drew those characters. They were the artist writers for those characters. It's an important question for comics history, but it also speaks to an issue that continues to plague the comics industry. Comic artists are routinely undercredited and underpaid, I might add, for the monumental contributions they've made to popular culture. So, that was our little disclaimer. With all of that in mind, we hope you enjoy this conversation with Abraham Reisman. All right, everyone. Our very special guest today is Abraham Reisman. He is a critically acclaimed writer who currently writes for New York Magazine and Vulture. He graduated from Harvard in 2008 and spent a short time living in Seoul, South Korea. His most recent publication, True Believer, The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee, is available now wherever books are found. Abraham, welcome to Friends from Work.
I'm unbelievably flattered by that intro. you're the first person in the history of anything to, at least in my presence, refer to me as critically acclaimed.
Yeah.
And at first I was like, okay, and then I was like, oh, I guess technically I have been acclaimed by some critics. Not every critic, but like I can,
hey,
that's a weird thing to be able to say about oneself, but anyway, I'll take it.
Thank you. Some critics acclaiming. You know?
Yeah, no, it's all you really need is one critic to acclaim you. I passed that a while ago. So
Well, as far as I'm concerned, enough about me.
Thank you for having me on the show. I'm excited.
Oh, we're so glad to have you. And I would say not necessarily critic, but Neil Gaiman writing a blurb there.
Isn't that nuts? Here's the story behind that. Nobody's asked me about that and so far in the interview. So you're getting an exclusive here. I finished the first draft in December of 2019. Did a first pass revision of the full thing with my editor. And then in February, like February 20 something, it's almost exactly, now that I think about it, a year ago, I had a draft that my editor and I felt comfortable with sending out for advance blurbs or reader commentary. And so there was a very select group that I sent it out to, which ranged from a lot of just sort of random Twitter users whose judgment I really trust, to like randos on Facebook who are amateur comic book historians and know more detail than anybody in academia, just because there really aren't people in academia and it's an amateur pursuit, but a really important one. But then all the way up to like authors who I felt like, I don't know, it's kind of a Hail Mary, let's see what happens. One of the authors I thought, you know, who would kind of hit the target of what I was trying to go for was Neil Gaiman. And I'd interviewed Neil on a number of occasions, including one very memorable occasion in Chicago in 2017, where we met up at a sushi restaurant. He had no entourage or assistant or anything. It was just him, you know, dressed like a schlub, as was I was a little dressed up, but God bless him. He just came kind of wearing whatever. It was all black, I should point out. He was wearing all black, but it was just a little, you know, whatever. Not criticizing, just trying to give you the vibe. And we talked for like an hour and a half. And it was a great conversation. We had this terrific interview, and I'm really grateful that he gave me all that time. And it was right when American Gods was coming out. And then, so I had his Girl Friday, his amazing person who works with him and does a lot of stuff with him. Not just an assistant or publicist, like one of those people who really keeps his head screwed on straight. I reached out to her and was like, is there any chance Neil might be interested in reading this? Like, no pressure. And even if it's just, he tells me his thoughts on it and he hates it, I'd love to know. And I happened to be in LA for other stuff when I sent it to her. I was doing other book related stuff and other related stuff. And so I emailed her and she was like, you know, if you're in LA, come by to the office. Now, Neil wasn't there. He was in, I believe, New Zealand at that point. Okay. And so I went over to the offices of Neil Gaiman, where I met the person. And we had this great conversation about the book. And she was like, okay, I'll give this to Neil with a recommendation that he look at it, which was great. Now I figure it'll be months. This is all crazy at that point. But I'm like, okay, I'm still not getting my hopes up because, you know, Neil Gaiman's doing a lot of stuff. I'm not going to be the top priority. So, and the person was like, yeah, you know, he's really busy, so don't expect anything anytime soon. So, two days later, I get an email from Neil Gaiman with the subject line, "You bastard." and the email was basically, he was calling me a bastard because he was like, I had so many things I was on deadline for and that I should be doing. And I just wanted to read like the first chapter of your book and then move on to do all the stuff I'm on deadline for. But I started and I couldn't stop. And it was the nicest thing. It was the most amazing email. He was so nice. That. He was like, this was really good. And I would love to blurb it. And I said,
see, critically acclaimed.
Exactly. and so he wrote this amazing blurb. It literally was like 48 hours after I gave it to him. And it was the second blurb I got. First blurb was the amazing Sarah Weinman, who was this true crime writer and is brilliant. And then Neil Gaiman. And I was like, okay, I can hang up the Spurs. Like literally, if I only get these two, I will be totally happy and fine. And then other things happened as well. But Neil, I'll be forever grateful to Neil that he took the time to blurb it. That opened a lot of doors. There were a lot of people who, if you can send a long paragraph, long quote from Neil Gaiman about how good the book is, there are going to be other people who are interested in taking a look at it. So thank you to him. I just got a note because I sent him a signed copy of the book. I hope that wasn't too self-aggrandizing a story.
No. I think it's funny that that's what he said, because I sort of had a similar situation with, you know, for our listeners, the book just was released less than a week ago, I guess, right on Tuesday.
Tuesday, I'm sorry, Tuesday the 16th,
And we, you know, I've just been in the middle of all of this Texas weather stuff for, you know, whenever this releases, that's kind of how we've been recording. And so it was a crazy week with work. And whenever I got a copy, it was the same thing where I had all this other stuff I needed to be doing, but I couldn't put it down. It was like, I'm not just saying that because we have you on. It really was just like, I flew through it. So fantastic job.
I really appreciate that. I really appreciate that.
So full disclosure, we are a TV and film review podcast, mainly a Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast. Sure. And so before we kind of dive into the nitty gritty of the book, I want to start here. Mm-hmm. What is your history with Marvel? And like, what led you to want to write this book?
My history with Marvel here, I'm looking for, one sec, I have to show you something. was my introduction to Marvel. I was in, I believe, first grade. I went to, this was in suburban Illinois, a suburb of Chicago. I went to a Scholastic book fair this book that I recently found at my mom's house. The Marvel Superheroes Guidebook,
which
is this long. It is, you know, a real tome. And it's basically here. I'll just show you. It's basically just entries on like weapons and who the characters are. And
I love that.
It's great. And so before I was even reading the comics or watching the cartoons, because the cartoon, the Spider-Man and X-Men cartoons and Marvel Action Hour had not started as of when I was in first grade. This was like, this blew my mind because even just reading, you know, all these tiny little written for kids capsule summaries just sounded so interesting to me. I remember reading, they have it's so funny. They have a little entry on Secret Wars the first Secret Wars. And I remember it's way better having now actually read Secret Wars. The imagination version of Secret Wars that I dreamed up just based on this tiny little capsule is better than actual Secret Wars. And I bet I'm not the only person who had that experience. It's just...
Well, and it's wild because you've now interviewed Jim Shooter.
A bunch of times. That's... Look, the side note, before I get back, remind me to come back to my Marvel story. Side note, one of the most interesting things about having been given this amazing opportunity and being so lucky as to be able to report on the comics industry for a mainstream outlet in the past better part of a decade, primarily for Vulture New York Magazine. Mm-hmm. One of the amazing results of that is I've gotten to interview and like sometimes extensively and multiple times a bunch of people who... People like you and I come up thinking, oh, these are celebrities. What you learn when you start reporting in the comics industry is none of these, if you're not Stan Lee or Neil Gaiman and maybe Todd McFarlane and Rob Liefeld, you're not actually a celebrity. None of them are. Like, and that's not a diss. That's like a diss to the industry. Like the industry sucks and has for a long time. And that's a reason why these people are not rich and famous, despite creating these stories that change everything. But, you know, reporting on them, you just get a sense of how true that is. You, basically, you can find and talk to anybody. None of these people, again, unless you're like Neil Gaiman or Todd McFarlane, you're not doing, there's no gatekeeper. If there's a gatekeeper, it's just because Marvel set up the interview and it's about an upcoming Marvel book. And then, of course, there's a mediator. But if you're reporting on like history, if you're reporting on stuff that has, that is not involved in like a current thing, you can just call anybody and they will tell you a lot. Like,
that's wild.
Well, nobody's doing this. Like we're all, I don't know what the deal is, but everyone just sort of sits back and goes, you know, the assumption is the comics world. Well, either that's not worth investigating or I probably know all I need to know. My editor can't get, you know, I can't get my editor to let me write this thing. Like there's all these reasons that nobody bothers to just call up, say, Jim Shooter. And we sit back and think like, here's this titan, like this guy who really altered the course of popular culture. And he did in his way. He altered the course of popular culture forever. He's not living in the Ritz-Carlton, you know? I mean, this is, he's like, he wouldn't even take me to his apartment. He went to another person's apartment a friend of his, and we looked at these giant binders of his Stan memorabilia. And like, I've seen him at cons and that's what he's there with. Like, he doesn't have things. People will bring things for him to sign, but he doesn't have anything to sell. He usually brings these binders of his memorabilia, most of which has to do with Stan.
So if you found a public figure in a different area that altered culture as much as like they did, they would be much larger at that point.
It'd be really hard to get in touch with them.
Yeah,
but you have these people who are like, or, you know, if it's in some realms, it's like if the person like becomes a drug addict or whatever and their life goes down the tubes, then maybe they're not as don't have those intermediaries, et cetera. But like in comics, you can live a completely clean life, not make any mistakes, manage your money really well, and still not be famous, you know, and still not be recognized for these amazing things you did. Like, years ago, I guess 2016, I wrote a short profile of Louise Simonson, Wheezy Simonson, who was the editor and writer, on the X-Men in this unbelievably influential period.
Right.
Wheezy was and is a genius. And I 2016 X-Men Apocalypse was coming out. She and the artist, Butch Guice, they invented Apocalypse. Like, it's just, it was two people. They came up with Apocalypse, and the initial idea was hers. It's still obviously a co-creation because the visual is so important, but just the progenitor of the initial spark of the idea was Louise Simonson. And 20th Century Fox wouldn't even invite her to the premiere.
Wow.
Can you imagine?
Wow.
She was not invited. They hate that they have to deal with creators. They don't want
anything
to
do with— Why wouldn't she not get the invite?
Because they don't want to acknowledge the creators, because once you start to acknowledge the creators, people start asking questions. Yeah. If you just act like, okay, this is a piece of branded IP and I don't know, the brand came up with it, then you don't have to deal with egos and you don't have to inflate the importance of people who then might get ideas about trying to get recognition or get a cut of the action. You know, I mean, Jim Starlin, who created Thanos, whole cloth, that's visual and concept. That is all Jim Starlin. Starlin invented Thanos. Without Jim Starlin gets hit by a bus in 1969. There is no Thanos. Mm-hmm. And that means the Marvel Cinematic Universe is completely different. It's just a completely different entity.
Right.
And that entity matters because it's made more money than the GDP of a small country.
Yeah, right.
And as of, I believe it's like 2016 or 2017, he gave a quote where he was like, I got paid more by Warner Brothers for the use of KG Beast, just by his civilian name, in Batman versus Superman for 5 minutes than I got paid by Marvel for the use of Thanos in all of his movies so far.
Wow.
That's wild.
That was because DC at for certain point in its history had a royalty sharing agreement where if you created a character and it was deemed not completely derivative of some other character, then you could share some of the royalties. But it's not the same as having ownership, like, by any means.
Sure.
But it's at least something that gives the person an automatic cut. And that he got this cut for KG Beast, according to him. And it was good. And the cut, you know, and he was not satisfied with what was happening with Thanos. And I interviewed him years later, and he said that he'd worked something out with them. But that's crazy that was not just automatic. Yeah. But that's how the industry was built. They didn't have to. It was work for hire.
Yeah.
You know, he knew what he was getting into. It was the industry standard. They don't owe him anything legally. It's just eventually he caused enough of a fuss, and it was such a high-profile concept and conflict. Even though it didn't get that much news, it's just so on its face completely nuts that they caved. And he wouldn't give me the details of what the arrangement is. He just said he was satisfied with it now, and it was water under the bridge. But the point that it is that, like, if the fact that was not automatic is completely nuts.
Right.
Yeah.
I think that's why it's interesting, you know, when we talk about Jim Shooter, and our listeners may not know, aside from being one of the more famous editors at Marvel, he also wrote the Secret Wars event, which I think you could argue, you know, you could argue that Secret Wars doesn't happen, so the MCU doesn't happen.
Sure. In some ways, yeah. I mean, it's arguably the first event crossover.
Right.
You know, an event crossover. Obviously, we'd already had shared universes and smaller level crossovers, but this was one where the entirety of Marvel for the, you know, all intents and purposes, was in one spot having this mm-hmm. big crossover event. And it was like this big summer blockbuster approach. And it had like, you know, licensing tie-ins. And that's, you're right. That's the beginning of a concept that then comes to dominate Marvel, which is every year you have to have some gigantic event where mm-hmm. all the, everything comes together and everybody has to deal with the fact that the story is being upended, which is like this extreme version of the Stan Lee vision of a shared universe. By the time Jim Shooter does that, yeah, he completely revolutionizes the way Marvel does business. And on top of that, sets this template for, yeah, these, you know, Avengers 2012, you know, the movie right. style crossovers, where it's just every thread has to come together for this thing.
Mm-hmm. I'm glad you raised that. I'm not forgetting to go back to your Marvel thing here in a second, mm-hmm. but just because you talked about Stan Lee there, and sort of the idea of the shared universe. One of the things I thought was really interesting in your book is you talk about, and you really can't talk about Stan Lee without talking about some of the controversy around what he did or didn't create. Sure. And I won't necessarily make you go down that road here because I'm sure you've already gone down that a lot. I thought it was interesting. Yeah, you said that one thing you really can't dispute is that Stan Lee was the creator of the kind of quote unquote shared
universe, the interconnected. No one else has claimed credit for it. And specifically Jack Kirby, who would be the only person that you can imagine having that, I mean, that level of right. ability to implement that, because Jack was working on so many books and because Jack was this creative powerhouse. Jack's the only candidate really for another person who could have come up with it. And according to Mark Evanier, his assistant and biographer, and just one of the great comics historians, mm-hmm. Jack hated the shared universe thing because it meant he had to deal with other people's stories and the stories he was writing. Mm. And he just didn't want to bother with that. But you know, Stan, it was an implementation of an idea that Stan had, and it turns right. out to be enormously consequential for pop culture. It's to a certain degree for a long while, and then starting around, you know, 2008 with the advent of the Marvel Cinematic Universe, mm-hmm. it becomes this world-changing, you know, tectonic shift in filmmaking and television making. You know,
right?
Mm-hmm. Anyway, sorry.
Well, no, it's interesting because, you know, whenever I think of Stan and what he seems to have contributed on some level, regardless of whose accounts you believe, is I feel like he pushed for that connected universe and also seemed to push for a certain kind of human approach to writing these heroes. Whether or not you would say he succeeded, I felt like that was something that he at least outwardly pushed for, was trying sure. to make them sound like someone you would know.
Yeah. Yes. I mean, yes. But for the standards of the times when it came to superhero comics, it was definitely more conversational or at least snappy, you know? Mm-hmm. It's funny to read now and to hear from people who were reading it at the time, hear them say, well, it was so realistic, because you read it now and it's just the most stilted, corny
right,
thing.
Right, right.
But, you know, you grade it on a curve. It was completely different from yep. mm-hmm. how superhero comics had traditionally been done. You know, you can go too far and say like it was the first time it had been done in comics, but that's not sure. true. I mean, like EC had done plenty of stuff that was that snappy and direct. It's just superhero comics that had not mm-hmm. really been done. But yeah, when it comes to the humanity of the characters that Stan was writing, you know, some of that is surely, you know, gets wrapped up in the question of who created the characters, because a lot of them, the humanity comes just in the pitch.
Right.
And that the core humanity factor, and that would be something you could attribute to whoever came up with the character. But when it came to dialogue and narration, yeah. Certainly, you know, his writer artists were the ones doing the first pass of the story for the most mm-hmm. part. But sometimes there was a longer conversation beforehand in the story conference. Sometimes there was no conversation. It was just a one-way thing, allegedly. Mm-hmm. But it's hard to say. What I'm getting at is it's hard to say what Stan really contributed specifically.
Right.
Mm-hmm, so you right. can go too far in that. I mean, one thing that really surprised me as I was doing the research for the book was the fact that Steve Ditko, in one of his mail order pamphlets where he mm-hmm. writes, you know, the sort of one-way communication where you couldn't get him to respond to questions, but he would just write these manifestos. Hmm. One thing he said was he and Stan really clashed over the fact that he, Ditko, wanted it to be more rooted in humanity and Stan wanted it to be more fantastical. Specifically, he was talking about the story early on, and I believe it's Amazing Spider-Man number one. I will apologize that sometimes it's hard for me to recall exact numbers, especially in the first few Amazing Spider-Mans, because there's so many individual stories in one issue, it's kind of hard to remember where they were. But anyway, early on, there's one where Spider-Man has to go intercept a space capsule on a rocket ship.
Right, right. And yeah, I think that is issue number one.
I think it's one, yeah. Again, it was one of the stories in one. And Ditko writes about that. And he was like, I was like, that's nuts. That's like a teenage, you know, him succeeding in that is like a, you know, a teen football player succeeding in the Super Bowl. Like it's completely implausible and it totally unmoors the story from the lived reality of a teenager. So, you know, we don't know the degree to which Stan was the one contributing the feet of clay or the humanity, et cetera, et cetera.
Right.
It really is. I just caution everybody when it comes to any comic with Stan's credit on it, especially from the 60s, just don't assume that all of the plot and character and dialogue stuff is just him. You can't, the credits are unbelievably misleading to the point of being lies. He was not the sole writer. And in, you know, by even by his own discussion, and admission before he really changed his story, very often those stories were just the first pass, and not just the first pass, but the idea was just the writer-artist, specifically Kirby most of the time. And, you know, so you just can't conclusively say, this one says it was written by Stan, that must mean the story and character elements are things that Stan came up with or at least participated in. You genuinely don't know. He may have not participated in any of the genesis of it and was just embellishing with dialogue and narration, which is still important, but is not the same as coming up with, you know, let's say humanity for a character.
Well, it's interesting. Some folks may not be familiar with the quote unquote Marvel method.
Oh yeah. Sorry. Sometimes I go down that path without explaining what I'm talking about, but.
Oh, no worries. I thought this just might be a good time. If you could speak to that. Briefly,
yeah. So Stan throughout his career, was not a big writer of scripts. It's not that he never did it, but very often he would have, you know, an initial, let me put it this way. He was not sitting down writing a script the way that you would think a comic would be written and the way that, you know, movies and television shows are written. He was not sitting down and saying, here is what happens in this panel and here's what they are saying and here's what the narration says. Okay, and then the next panel, they're doing this and blah, blah, blah. That's what you would expect. He was almost never doing that. What I found was that was true even going back to the 40s. People talk about it as being a thing that was invented in the late 50s, but it goes back a long way. It was just sometimes there were scripts that he was not writing. He would come up with something initially, then hand it off to a script writer, whatever. The point is, by the 60s, it turns into this thing where every issue is slightly different, but the rough outline of how it would work is there would be some kind of discussion between Stan and whoever his quote-unquote artist was for that issue. Of course, they're really writer-artists, but let's just for the sake of clarity call them the artists for here. There would be some kind of discussion between Stan and the artist. And again, by Stan's own admission, sometimes that was, you know, the two of them having an in-depth conversation. Sometimes it was Stan saying, let's bring back Dr. Doom for this issue. Now you go figure out the rest. And sometimes it was Kirby. We don't know. He didn't admit about other people, but sometimes Kirby, when he was working with him, Kirby would just say, here's what we're doing. And Kirby said that was almost always the case, that he would just call Stan or go visit Stan in the office and say, here's what I'm doing this month. Stan would say, sure, maybe have a note or two, and then Kirby would go do it. And then eventually Stan would have the dialogue and narration. The artist would then go home after that conversation, whether it was one way or two way, who knows, and then would draw the whole issue, which is in comics a form of writing. You're plotting, the whole plot of the issue would be there on the pages. And a lot of times the artist, whatever, would write dialogue suggestions or narration suggestions in the margins. Now, it wasn't that detailed, but It was not, they were even participating in that process. Right. And then they would bring the pages back with the plot created and with notes in the margins. And Stan would then add the dialogue and narration, which again is really important because a lot of these guys could not write dialogue, or they certainly couldn't do it in as engaging a way as Stan did. Mm-hmm. But the point is, Stan was not the primary writer on these stories. Right. He was a writer, but he was not, by my judgment call, I would say he was not the primary writer on anything where he did not, where the plot itself was actually constructed in a concrete way by the artist, which is to say virtually all of these comics. So anyway, that was the Marvel method in outline. But as you may have picked up from me saying it, there were variations on it and no one issue was exactly the same. And for example, with Steve Ditko, the co-creator of Spider-Man, and the writer artist for the first 36 issues, after you know years of conflict with Stan or frustration with Stan, he got Stan to let him make the plots on his own without any input from Stan, and then Stan would get Stan would go in, as he described it, as being like a crossword puzzle. Where like he would just get these pages from Ditko, not having been involved in any stage of the creative process up to that point, and then would just interpret what was there and try and fill in, you know, to make it flow. You know, of course, and for those, Stan was still listed as writer, and you know, it was you know, it's the credits were all, you know, even on the early ones where Stan was not having any input on the initial story, he was still getting billed as like story by. I mean, it's crazy. You look at the credits and they're just, it's crazy that in the, again, side note, that the industry has spent and the mainstream press has spent, you know, the better part of a century just not acknowledging any of this and just pretending it's not there when it's all, even beyond the difficult questions of like who created these characters, you have really simple questions like, okay, who is the primary writer here? And there's a very obvious answer. Again, I think if you're being honest and it's the writer artist. And that doesn't mean Stan's not a writer. It doesn't mean he doesn't have a crucial role in it, but he's not the primary writer. And we're not talking about Jack Kirby as a writer. We're not talking about Steve Ditko as a writer. We do in certain cloistered comic circles.
Yeah.
But for the most part, the mainstream person has absolutely no idea about any of this because it has been in the interests of major corporations and lazy journalists to just present this completely, you know, bowdlerized version of how these comics were made. And there are consequences for it. Anyway, I've talked now for like 15 minutes without pause.
In going through all your research for this book, I'm interested to hear, what would you say one way your respect for Stan Lee has increased and one way it's decreased?
I don't like thinking in terms of that way because I don't really want to opine on sort of my personal feelings about Stan. But I will say I hadn't thought through how much, I don't know if this is respect, but I'll give you a rough answer to this. I had not thought about the degree to which the interconnected universe is really him. That was just his baby. I hadn't not thought that, but I just hadn't really pondered it that much. And I certainly didn't know that Kirby did not claim it and that nobody else claimed it. Again, just because I hadn't investigated, it hadn't occurred to me. And for the average person, it didn't occur to them. And if it's like a footnote. But after a while, you go, that was a pretty amazing impact that idea.
Yeah.
And that's him. The person who it could have also been did not like it and nobody else has claimed it. And then I'm trying to think, what's something that was,
or maybe just something you learned that shocked you the other way.
That shocked me. Another thing that's hidden in plain sight. This was something that shocked me. That there's no evidence that Stan created these characters. That like there's no hard evidence. The only thing, the claim that Stan is the creator of these characters is Stan's word. There's no presentation boards. There's no diary entries. Mm-hmm. There's no accounts from unbiased third parties. None of that. I'm not saying that necessarily means he had nothing to do with the creation. Mm-hmm. of these characters, but there's no evidence of it. It's crazy. That it was so astounding to me when I realized there was nothing, that we've all been basing this on the word of one man who had a tremendous interest in lying about it if that was not the case. Mm-hmm. You know, a guy lied a bunch of times about other stuff in very demonstrable ways. It's just, it's mind-boggling that, again, it has taken this many decades for the look, my book is getting a lot of press. Part of that, I hope, is because I wrote a good book. I did my best. But the reason that it's getting all this press is not because my book being good, hopefully, is not getting in the way of anything. It's about, there's this pent up, you know, delusion or lie or whatever. There's this blockage that has kept this story from being told. And now that it's being told, it was really just my job to not get in the way of it. Like, I didn't have to embellish this story. There are like a few lines that I look back on now and I go, like, I was overstating my argument there. Like, I kind of embellished it. And the reason I think that is because I didn't have to embellish this story. The bare facts of the Stan Lee story, once you actually find out as many facts as you can and look at them not through the eyes of fandom, you see that it's this astounding story. And my job was to just tell it and not overstate it to the point where people are going to go, he's making, you know, a mountain out of a molehill. I had to just stick to the facts to the best of my ability. And that's a story that needed to be told. Again, this is not me saying, I'm trying not to toot my own horn here.
No.
What I'm saying is just there, it's this, the story, all of the Stan Lee story, but especially the creative credit question for the Marvel Universe, it's the mind boggles at the fact that it had not been reported in a mainstream outlet at length until I wrote this profile in 2016.
One other bit I found particularly interesting is you bring up Marvel's issue with meaningful deaths and with Gwen Stacy specifically. That's funny to us because that's actually something we've talked about in our podcast a lot regarding the MCU specifically and how they've gotten better at it. But, you know, the juxtaposition of if you kill a character, then there's all the stories you can't tell. But if you don't ever kill them, then do the consequences ever feel real? Can you explain that a little bit more?
Wait, I'm sorry. What do you mean?
Just when you bring up Gwen Stacy in the book. And
I do,
how, that Stan Lee didn't want her to die, right?
Well,
or at least that he says now.
He says that he was not he later in life he said that
he wasn't interested in killing these characters.
That he didn't want but according to Jerry Conway, who was the writer on the issue where Gwen Stacy died, according to Jerry Conway, he told Stan, he's 100% certain that he told Stan and Stan signed off on it. But then fans were very upset about the comic. And according to Jerry's theory is that once he started getting yelled at by college students, Stan just said, oh, well, I had nothing to do with this. They must have approved that when I was on vacation. Again, the truth is elusive. It's a conflicting story. I don't think we can firmly say Stan didn't. I mean, there's a quote that's attributed to him, sort of. I believe it was Roy Thomas who said it in an interview, which is that Stan used to say, you want the illusion of change, not actual change. Now, I always hasten to point out that we don't know Stan said that. That's hearsay. That is not a direct quote from him. But it certainly, fits with the general approach that he had. You know, there's change, but not really like, I take that back. Stan actually did have some fundamental changes and there were things with consequences, but death was not something that was really on the table in any kind of major way until the death of Gwen Stacy. I'm forgetting something.
But, right. And I think that's why a lot of people consider that to be sort of the end of the quote.
Yeah, it's the end of the Silver Age. That's the beginning of the Bronze Age where things get a little more intense. Who knows the degree to which Stan signed off on it? Maybe he did say yes and just wasn't really paying attention to what was presented to him. I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
It's one of the many ambiguities. Yep.
Well, I was struck in general reading, as a Marvel Cinematic Universe podcast, we're, viewing a lot of this through a certain lens, although I'm a big comics reader as well. But I just kept thinking how with Stan being the kind of proponent of the shared universe that we've talked about, and also kind of being the guy that at least had his hands in most things, at least for the one sort of formative period.
He was a great editor.
Right. Well, and I kept thinking, you know, I feel like if there is a big issue with the Marvel method as Stan did it, it would seem to be more his inability to give credit where credit was due, not necessarily the process itself. Because
the artists, writer artists, very often, you know, not universally, but a lot of them really liked the technical and artistic aspect of the Marvel method, just the mechanics of it. John Romita Sr. gave me a quote where he was like, it becomes a visual medium, which is a remarkable thing to say, because comics is a visual medium and has been for whatever, however long you want to say the history of comics is. But for him to say the Marvel method made him finally feel like it was a visual first medium, that's a big thing for an artist to say. And there were a lot of people who felt that way. It allowed for creativity and guidance. I mean, guidance is the right word. It put the artist in the driver's seat, basically, and let them go where they needed to go, which is why I say they're the primary writer on it. But like that meant that they could let their freak flags fly to a certain extent and kind of play to their strengths and not be constrained by the tyranny of a script. But they were not getting paid as writers, and they were not getting the credit that was obviously due to them.
Because I hear that, and I can't help but think of the role that I think we at least tend to ascribe to Kevin Feige within the MCU. You know, the difference being obviously that the writers and directors of the films are given due credit. I don't think anyone thinks that Feige is himself writing, although, you know, my sense is he makes some story additions here and there.
But a lot of people sort of, when they talk about the general story, because the general story transcends any individual movie with a director and a writer, people, when they talk about the direction of the meta story, not just the real life story, although they talk about that as well, but talking about like, you know, phase one, phase two, phase three, phase four, you ascribe some degree of authorship to Kevin Feige because it's the same thing you do with Stan Lee. It's just easier cognitively to think one person is the main person doing this. And it's just never the case in something as intricate as like a Marvel universe. It was not a one-man band for Stan. It was close to a one-man band in some ways for Jack Kirby, but even then it was not just him. And same with Kevin Feige and the people that helped create and perpetuate the Marvel Cinematic Universe. You know, I'm not as much of an expert on that because it's such a closed box. You know, I've tried doing reporting on the MCU, and they just don't want to participate. Like you know, that it's so choreographed. It's so unbelievably choreographed. And you're just living at their whim to a certain
extent.
What was I talking about? Sorry, I keep going on these ranting
just talking
tangents.
About sort of the
Kevin
way
Feige,
the culture.
Right. Yeah, right. So I've tried to find out more about what happens behind the scenes, and it's just, it's so hard. Mm-hmm. He's locked up so tight. You know, comics is the easy way out, and you know, contemporary comics, it's a little harder, like stuff that's currently happening, but even there, it's not that hard compared to like the sniper NDAs that the MCU actors, et cetera, and writers have to sign. Anyway, what were you going
to
say?
Well, I know you got the chance in the book to speak at least with the Russo brothers.
I didn't speak to them for the book. I did it for a short interview for Vulture. That was pegged to Endgame.
Fans, so.
Endgame, I enjoyed Endgame. I didn't like it the first time, and then I watched it the second time and cried like a baby. I was speaking to them just at a junket after the movie came out. They were like, you know, this is how big Disney movies are. You can have a junket after the movie comes out, and that way you don't have, you know, you can do spoilers finally. But like, people are still going to be talking about your movie that long because you dominate the media environment so much. You can get away with like doing the Russo brothers junket. I'm not complaining. It's just an interesting fact.
Disney
can do that. You know, I was like a couple of weeks after the movie had been out I went to, you know, some hotel in New York and in Manhattan and interviewed them. And I was working on the book already. So I was like, I'll, you know, it's also just interesting to talk to the one is you can read the rest of the interview at Vulture. And I asked them about Stan. And then I'm sort of quoting my own article in the book because they were. What were you going to ask about that?
Well, sorry, I was just, I was curious because you talk about that being sort of a black box.
That was a rare thing where like they can, you know, that's not that secretive. They don't have to hide that Stan liked to do his own additional lines when he would show up for the cameos. You know, that's right. Just a cute story. It's instructive. Like they're thinking of it just as it's a cute story. But for me as the biographer, and I put it, you know, collate it with all the other factors, then it's like, oh, this is interesting. Like he would just come and, you know, make up lines because he wanted to have more lines. He really loved doing those cameos and wanted more time on screen. And, you know, that's not, you know, an expose. It's just when you put it together with all these other data points about all the other cameo situations that led up to the MCU cameos, you know, it becomes slightly interesting. I keep talking over you. I'm sorry.
No. I think the question I'm dancing around here, and maybe it's not even a question as much as just an observation, is as I look, you know, I feel like a lot of the story that you've told here is Stan having this moment where it seemed like everything he touched turned to gold, you know, at least like, right. And kind of at least by his telling, or at least, you know, even objectively, just the stuff that Marvel was putting out then. And then after that, there was a lot of him trying to kind of pitch either new ideas or convince people that he had these film adaptations available for some of the characters he had worked on. And it struck me how much a lot of what he seemed to be envisioning could be described as a lot of what we got ultimately in the MCU, obviously, you know, through other people, but it was a little... It was sad to me to see how much, you know, in the 80s and 90s, he was trying to make that happen and convinced that that could happen, and how much it seemed that people just weren't buying it, whether that was because they didn't believe in the idea or they didn't believe in him and the talent he had assembled. But then to see, you know, like you say, the massively successful thing that now is the Marvel Cinematic Universe is just interesting to me in life.
No, it is. I mean, and... You know, the reasons that those movies didn't come together are unique to every single movie. I mean, making a movie, like getting a movie to be made at all is a miracle in Hollywood. Not just not just a superhero movie, whatever. You know, 99% of movies that could exist don't exist and just don't make it through the process. But, you know, there were a lot of structural factors. CGI did not exist. Like you could not do special effects at scale for, that would look good. And you need, when it comes to superhero action,
right?
Superhero movies look ridiculous if they don't have a pretty elaborate approach to special effects. I mean, like there are ones from the pre-CGI era that work, but no, I mean, there's a lot that don't work. And then the ones that do work, but they're very visually elaborate. Like they make up for the fact, like the Donner Superman, obviously, Superman and Batman 89 and Batman Returns. Those are just so, I mean, with Donner, they just did it like this gorgeous stuff that, for whatever reason, still maybe it's nostalgia, but it still seems to work. And Batman 89, it's just the Art Deco thing is just so striking that you're not even paying attention to. I mean, if anything looks ridiculous, it almost feels of a piece with the whole bit. Like everything's kind of over the top. But for the most part, until like episode one in The Matrix completely changed the nature of visuals and CGI in movies, period. Prior to that, it was really hard to make a superhero movie that didn't look ridiculous. And that's a huge factor.
That's a great point.
That's, it's not just Stan was a bad salesman or whatever, pitch man, although that may have been part of it, you know, in some cases at least. But when it came to selling these Marvel characters, I think a big impediment was they just look ridiculous. Right. Like, mm-hmm. And the very idea of it is ridiculous. I mean, think about the Spider-Man TV show with Nicholas Hammond and the way they had to depict him crawling up walls where he's just sort of waving, you know, the stuntman's waving his hands.
Mysterio with the fishbowl.
Exactly.
Right.
It's crazy. You couldn't make stuff look good at scale during that whole period. And then eventually, you know, also, yeah, it's a generational thing where mm-hmm. the executives he's talking to in the 70s, 80s, 90s are people who did not grow up loving Marvel, you know, necessarily. Because we're talking like old guys. It's Altacockers who are in charge of studios. So they are not the demographic that grew up being huge fans of Marvel. They're really skeptical about this stuff when he walks in the room. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I always come back to the CGI just because I think it's something people don't pay enough attention to, that really is what enable, you know, because episode one of The Matrix come out in 99. And the process of making them and then the aftermath are just a complete sea change in the way movies are made, at least blockbuster movies.
Mm-hmm.
But really, in a lot of ways, all movies, you know, as extensions of things that happened in the making of those. And all of a sudden you can make stuff that looks okay. And then also Lord of the Rings and the Weta Workshop stuff.
Right.
You know, you have this like period right around the turn of the millennium where visual effects advances to a point where you can make this stuff look not terrible.
But do you think that the filmmakers that he was pitching those characters to at that time were aware of that? Or did they think at that
cutting
edge, you know?
I'd kind of be speaking out of my butt to say that I know a lot about why those things were rejected. You know, I know what people have told me, but most of those are people who were close to Stan as opposed to people who rejected Stan. And a lot of those people are just not alive because those studio heads and big producers are, you know, were pretty old back then and now they're gone. So yeah, I will confess that's, I only know what like Margaret, you know, some people, like I talked to Margaret Lesh, his partner at Marvel Productions. And according to her, it really did come down to just these people thought that superheroes were ridiculous and didn't want to do anything with them. And I'm sure that is a huge factor in it. And part of that is the implicit factor, or maybe in some of these conversations it would be explicit, but certainly the implicit factor of special effects not being able to make, because you'd seen stuff where it looked stupid. Like you'd seen how bad it could look. And then therefore you're really skeptical about the ability for it to, I'm doing a lot. This is hypothetical because I was not sure of these things. But I'm pretty sure that was a factor.
Well, it is interesting because you bring up Thanos earlier. And I mean, I almost feel like we have to be grateful that someone didn't try to make Thanos in the 90s.
You know, I mean, there were probably people who could have done it. I can imagine like a cool like puppet Thanos that like, you know, the Henson production facility would have made. Or, you know, the effects team that did the thing, like you could do interesting stuff, but very few people could do that in a way that would work at scale. And especially with Thanos, you're right. Cause Thanos is such a goofy looking dude, you know, with the purple and the ridged chin,
the nutsack of a chin.
Yeah. The nutsack of a chin. Right. Exactly. It's like, you're right. That would have been hard to pull off.
It's interesting also because you talk about how a lot of these people weren't folks that were raised on Marvel, that maybe they just thought superheroes were inherently ridiculous. And I think it's so interesting how that has kind of the view on comics and on superheroes in particular has seemed to shift so much over the decades.
It's 180 degrees. It's the complete opposite. Now, like to get in the room, you have to be able to sell something, either superheroes or something that uses kind of a superhero model. And that's one of the reasons why like shared universes were a fad for a while. But anyway, it's completely changed. What was the question?
Well, cause even like, back when you're talking about the Lee Ditko Spider-Man stuff coming onto the scene and you talk about certain kind of quote unquote pop culture snobs sort of viewing that as sort of at the time, up and coming, interesting thing.
Yeah, it was very hot. It was very hip.
Right. And I think that's an interesting way of putting it because I would think now, even though Marvel movies are super successful, they're, you know, generally seen as the more mainstream thing. It's not hip necessarily.
That's a great point.
You know?
Yeah. Now it is not seen as it's the culture. It's not the counterculture. It's the complete right. opposite yeah, of counterculture. Right. It's this is the dominant mode. Like the superhero fiction is by some definition of dominant, the dominant mode and genre in cinema. The closest rival to it is Pixar movies, which are also made by Disney.
You know? Yeah, right.
And wild. Within superhero fiction, the dominant mode is Marvel. They set the mm-hmm. agenda. However much the release the Snyder Cut people would like to say that he's a genius. Maybe he's a genius, but he's not setting the trends in the way that Marvel did. Right. And he's not making the money that Marvel has. And yeah, it's completely different. But there was a time when the whole argument for, you know, I mean, the Mary Marvel Marching Society song is you belong to the Mary Marvel Marching Society. The idea was you were part of something cool that not everybody was into. Hmm. You were into something that was, you know, whether you were a kid and it was like a cool thing or you were a college student and it was a counterculture thing you'd do while you smoked pot, you know, it was hip. And now the best you can hope for in terms of hipness is like having something that is slightly, you know, wackier. I mean, like WandaVision right now, which is airing, I don't know that it's hip. It's still something that it's really not countercultural. I don't know. I'm rambling it all in a way of just agreeing with you that, yeah, it's
it was different enough that it's shocking to some people. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you call that hip because it's still like their biggest thing.
It's still the MCU and it really obeys a lot of the rules of the MCU. Right. And that's, yeah, it's very interesting to see the contrast. You go back to 1964, 65, and It's one of the reasons that Village Voice story from 1965 is so interesting. Was it 64 or 65? I can't remember. Well, anyway, the point is, one of the reasons it's interesting is it's, I believe, the first real artifact you have of a reliable mainstream outlet chronicling how people feel about Marvel. Because there hadn't been much documentation, not just how they feel, but also what's happening with them. You know, there's this paragraph that I block quote where she's like saying, you know, examples. Now, I hope for the sake of history, she was not making this stuff up. But like she's saying, you know, such and such professor at such and such university is talking about Marvel in his lectures and such and such a place has this club. And like the point is that stuff was not being widely documented and it was not widely visible. You had to like know how to get into that and you had to find other people who were weird enough to like it with you. And Stan was a huge part of that. I swear to God, the number of people I interviewed who were boomers who grew up reading Marvel in the 60s and having their lives changed and their minds blown, the number of people I've spoken to who fit that description, who when I asked, what was it that kept you coming back? Their answer was the letters pages. You'd be shocked. So many people that say like the art was great, the writing was great, but what kept me coming back was the letters pages because it was so cool and I felt like I was part of something. You know, Stan talked to us and he didn't talk down to us and it was funny and he was very biting to the haters and we loved that. You know, clever when he was clever about everything, but especially when he was sort of getting a diss. Stan's soapbox was fun. The verbiage was exciting, you know, and the point was it was a message board before you had those. Like people would write in letters and you would see the letters posted and you would like find each other, but also you'd be reading you know, hopefully your letter would make it and you'd have this audience with Stan and also this audience with the entire rest of the fandom. And that was addictive for people. They loved that. And you can see why. Again, this is what we do now.
Early Reddit.
Right. This is what you do on Reddit. This is what you do for me on Twitter, for example. Uh-huh. You know, that's my online addiction.
@AbrahamJoseph.
Yeah, @AbrahamJoseph, everybody. Yeah. But, you know, people want to, it's so dumb to say, but people want to belong to something. People want to be a part of a community. Again, that's so simple, but that's really the simple pitch that led to people wanting to come back to Marvel Comics over and over again, because it was dear Stan and Jack, and Stan would write back to you. And you could just see how much he cared and how much he loved you. That's why it's so hard. I mean, there are a lot of people who are not going to like this book and never read it as well, because, you know, it's... You guys have seen They Live, right? The Roddy Piper movie, John Carpenter from the 80s.
I haven't.
Okay, well, you know, the basic setup is this guy finds a pair of sunglasses that when he puts them on, he sees the true nature of reality, which is like these demonic presences are rich people, you know, who are rich people control the world, and like there's subliminal messaging everywhere. Sounds and he John can Carpenter. See the truth. And there's this famous scene, that's this fight scene between Roddy Piper and Keith David, who plays is his friend. They're both like basically homeless. They're near this dumpster and they have this physical fight that is extremely well choreographed and believable. Like, it really just does look like two guys brawling, but in a way that's fascinating and elegant. But the thing is, they're fighting over the fact that the Roddy Piper character, the guy who's had the glasses, he's like, you need to put on these glasses. You need to look. And the guy's like, I don't want to look. And they have this fight that's just him saying, put on the glasses. You put on the glasses. You have to look at this. And there are so many people who, I get it. I'm not, I really don't fault anyone. But if you have that kind of relationship, that parasocial relationship with a figure like Stan Lee.
Yeah.
It's a total uphill battle to get somebody like that to put on the sunglasses and see what's really there. And I think if people look and actually read the book, they'll see that it is not a hatchet job. It is not me trying to cancel somebody. But like here, you know, let me put it this way. The number one negative comment I get, like the modal comment that I get that's negative, the one that as an individual idea pops up more often than any other one, the plurality, is fall, responding to the subheading of my book. The Rise and Fall of Stan Lee. Fall, he never fell. How dare you?
Yeah.
And what's fascinating to me about that is, even beyond my book, even beyond the moral definition of fall, of like, you know, did he do something wrong? At the very bare minimum, the last year and a half of Stan's life were extremely publicly awful. Like, that was not new reporting in my book. And that was not something you had to look too hard to find. And still you have people in the comments who are out of the mode of being Stan super fans, out of the mode of loving him, out of having that desire, they say, he never fell. When it's like, were you paying attention? Like, of course he fell. Again, I would argue that the fall is a more gradual thing, but at the very least, at the bare minimum, the last year and a half of his life was a complete collapse. Again, and even if you remove any idea that that's his fault, it's just that happened. What I'm getting at is, people don't want to associate negative feelings with Stan Lee. Stan Lee is a refuge for people, and I get that. People have this very passionate parasocial relationship with Stan Lee that is rooted in the idea that his story is happy. Like, it's not just that he did good, although that's a big part of it. It's not just that he loved you, which is also a big part of it. It's the story makes you feel good. And the idea of Stan, the end of Stan's life being miserable, is just something that for a lot of people, I think the brain just rejects. You don't want to associate elder abuse with Stan. You just want to go, he was in the movie cameos. It must have been great for him. And if somebody, if you hear any information about that, you go, I don't, fake news or la, 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 I'm not listening. Or you just don't remember it because you filter it out. And I'm not trying to be a hater. I'm just trying to say, like, there's more to this story. And I hope you give it a shot, try reading it or reading, you know, one of the many wonderful essays that has been written about it that I'm lucky enough to have seen written. And you'll see that it's not me just trying to blow up a spot. It's really just trying to be a journalist. And, you know, it's hard to get people to put on the glasses, but I hope they do.
Yeah, that's so interesting. Well, man, I really did enjoy the book so much.
Thank you.
I think that our listeners will too. And I really think that they'll appreciate getting to hear your insight here. I think it says a lot about Marvel, but also sort of informs the conversations Kyle and I have a lot about this movie universe and how they're made. and kind of the, you know, the larger narrative that these are just a part of.
Yeah.
So it's been such a pleasure having you. Yeah.
I really appreciate you
taking the time.
No. This was a good conversation. So
anywhere in particular people can find the book?
Yeah. Well, go to wherever books are sold, I encourage you to go to your independent bookseller, but if you want to buy it online, I have a link. I mean, you can go to bookshop.org, but there's also a link to it along with more information about the book and blurbs and reviews. If you're undecided, at my website, you can go to abrahamreisman.com. It's right there. Front page, so you can't miss it. If you really wanted to go directly, abrahamreisman.com/book, but why type
you'll find it.
You'll find it either way. And it's I before E, but if you do if you transpose the I and the E, I also registered that domain.
I love that.
Oh, nice.
Well, that's everybody gets it wrong. Thinking. It's the family curse. But
do you have R-E-E-S, man?
Yeah, I gotta get them all. It's all it's a Pokemon. Got to catch all the misspelling. Anyway, thank you guys so for having me on.
Yeah, thank you. It's been a pleasure. Woo! Hope you enjoyed that. The thing that I personally appreciated about Abraham is that he doesn't treat this as a black and white issue. As he noted in the interview, his book isn't some all-out attack on Stan, so be sure to still go read it wherever you find your books. On the contrary, he reminded me that even if Stan overstated his role in the creation of certain characters, there's simply no doubt it was Stan who gave us Marvel's like shared universe. And maybe even more importantly, he created that communal culture. That's the same communal culture that allows us to have so much fun on this podcast now. Stan understood that anything worth enjoying is worth enjoying with friends. So that's a philosophy that we have taken to heart here on Friends from Work. On that note, we appreciate you listening. And as always, we're blown away by your continued support. Check us out online at the FFW Podcast or theffwpodcast.com. And we can't wait to be back with you on Monday, where we're talking about WandaVision Episode 8 on Friends from Work.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.